Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Raina Starr. Desperate House Witches is rated R for language, content, and Raina Starr. And is brought to you by the one, the only, the incredible one herself, the amazing Dorothy Morrison. Check out www.wickedwitchstudios.com. And if you need Dorothy's products shipped overseas, check out www.theangrycauldron.com. But for Dorothy Morrison products, always visit www.theangrycauldron.com. Don't forget to vote for the 2020 Witchies. The post is up on the show page. Check it out. I had not heard of the Witchies before a few weeks ago, so it's kind of exciting. You get to vote for your writers, new writers, podcasts, no hints being dropped there much. But yeah, check it out. So anyway, with me for the hour to discuss her new book, or newest book, Badass Ancestors, is the lovely and wonderful Patty Wigington. Hey, Patty.
Hey, Raina. I'm so excited that I get to hang out with you this afternoon. This is great. I've missed talking to you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. And you have been, like, writer, you know, extraordinaire. You've got all kinds of stuff going on. So I haven't seen you since last Mystic South. What's going on? How are you dealing with stuff? How's the COVID situation in your neck of the woods? What's happening?
Oh, my gosh. So 2020 has just been an absolute shit show of a year, I think, for everybody. It's one of those years where we started off like normal, where we thought everything was going to be like, hey, festivals, hey, conferences, hey, book signings and workshops. And then in the middle of March, everything kind of went to hell in a handbasket. And I think for those of us who are creators of things, you know, artists and writers and podcasters and whatnot, It's been a very interesting sort of paradigm shift for the way we market things and the way we interact with people who want to consume the content we've created. So it's been a real challenge for me personally because, I've had two books come out so far this year. In April, I had Herb Magic come out, which you and I chatted about a while back. And so that came out in April, and, you know, when I normally would have been like, hey, I'm doing a big book launch, I'm doing book signings, I'm going to festivals, and I'm signing stuff, and I'm talking to people, and I'm interacting, now I'm just kind of like, hey, let's do a Zoom call and call it a day. So it's been a little odd. I feel like Zoom is my life now. And then Badass Ancestors obviously came out on September 8th from Llewellyn. And, again, it's one of the things where I would have done a huge launch. And instead what I ended up doing was taking advantage of the technology. And last night I did like an online virtual launch party with one of our local shops. And we all got on there from the comfort of our living rooms. So it's been really weird, but I've been staying busy. Like I said, I've had two books so far come out this year. I've been working on writing other stuff and creating more stuff in addition to doing my full-time job in the corporate world. So it's been interesting.
It has been interesting. I have to agree, because in addition to my corporate job, because everybody lost out on festivals this year, I've been trying to cram in as many shows as I can because folks have really lost a great deal of income not being able to do these in-person things. So, you know, up until Yule, I have, in some cases, four shows in a row, you know, which I'm grateful for. Don't get me wrong. Anything I can do to help the community is, you know, worthwhile in my opinion. and I can always sleep in January.
Right. Yes. Well, you and me both, sister.
I'm very well. I'm hoping that things go back to at least some kind of semblance of we can be in person. I don't know if there'll be a vaccine at that point. I kind of hope there is, because I sure would like to see folks in person again. It's been a really long time, and you know, but I'm doing everything I can to try to help, and I hope it's helping folks. That's all I can say. But anyway,
yeah,
your book is amazing, Badass Ancestors, and you know, you and I were talking a few minutes ago that you wrote this book before COVID, obviously, but I'm amazed at how timely it is. You know, so many folks have lost people, you know, for multiple reasons, including COVID, and it just seems like this was the perfect book at the perfect time. Did you have any kind of an inkling? Is this something that you had been planning to write way before you did it? I mean, how did these, it's purely kismet. These things just seem to happen, and everybody's writing amazing books this year. But I, of course, you know, and you've heard me say this before, your writing style is probably one of my favorites because you don't go over my head, which makes me feel okay. I can actually understand, you know, I don't need a degree to understand what you're writing. It's very helpful, especially for me having COVID brain, in the sense of, you know, all conversations seem to revolve around it. So it's like, holy crap, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. Tell me about the process of getting to this, because this is amazing.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. I'm so glad you love it. I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback from people so far. So I actually wrote this book over the summer of 2019. And obviously, I never sat down and thought, you know, this book is going to come in really handy if we ever are in the middle of a global pandemic. You know, that was not even something that was on my radar. But I think that it was a book that I had been sort of mapping out in my head for several years. It was something I had wanted to do because my ancestral veneration is a crucial part of my practice. It's really the foundation of my spiritual trajectory at this point. The way this kind of came about to actually fall into place, I had been doing workshops with people on working with their ancestors, and it's something I still do. I do them via Zoom now. But it was something I had sort of, I'd written an outline and I had sort of mapped out a couple of chapters. And, you know, I'm low-key obsessed with my own genealogical research. And I was chatting on Facebook one day with Alicia Gallo from Llewellyn Publications. And Alicia is also a big, she's really big into genealogy. You know, she and I have shared some really, really great stories about some just absolute batshit crazy stuff we found in our own family tree. And I mentioned to her, I was like, hey, you know what? I was like, I had to share this story with you about these people that I found. And I'm putting this in my book because I'm mapping out a book about working with your ancestors. And she was like, send it to me. so I was like, it's not finished yet. I have an outline and a couple of chapters. She's like, send it to me. So I did. And she pitched it to the acquisitions team at Llewellyn. And they liked what they were hearing. And I think, you know, one of the things that people not in the publishing industry don't often realize is that books are often written a year to a year and a half, sometimes 2 years before they're released. So the people in charge of deciding what gets read, they have to be thinking long range. They have to be thinking ahead. So it was just kind of fortuitous that there have been several books about ancestor veneration that have all sort of been released in the last 6 months. because these books were on the radar of the publishing companies, you know, a year, year and a half ago. But working with Llewellyn was great. Alicia is she's a dream to work with. She actually went to bat with me with the editorial committee because there was some question about whether they would keep my title of Badass Ancestors, and she really fought for it. So that's the reason it is called Badass Ancestors. I think there may have been folks who wanted to change it, but she totally took up the baton and I got what I wanted, which was the title that I had chosen. So
I think it's great. I can't imagine why there was any kind of discussion needed for that title.
Yeah.
Badass Ancestors.
I mean, it
is
fits.
Exactly
it
what
fits.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have women, you know, ancestors who are strong, strong women. And hell yeah, my grandmother would have loved it if you'd call her badass to her face.
Right? Exactly. But yeah, so that was kind of the process. Like I said, I never set out to write a book that was like, you know, here's a book to read during quarantine. That wasn't really the way it came about. It was just all kind of very timely. And I think, I don't know, I think in a way there maybe some of us felt like something big was coming and that it was time to start working with our ancestors. I don't know how many of us could have predicted the specifics of 2020, because honestly, it seemed like, you know, I mean, we had the murder hornets, we had, you know, storms, we had COVID, we had all kinds of stuff going on, we got politics, and everybody's just kind of over it. Like, we just need to, like, turn the year off and turn it back on again and see if it works better. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't have pandemic on my bingo card for this year.
No,
I don't know.
No, I had a lot of things on my bingo card, but that was not one of them.
Yeah, seriously, not. I mean, I don't know. I guess I got lulled into a perpetual state of comfort, thinking that, you know, because politics, for the most part, not that we haven't had insane people before, but I mean, the craziest thing I had ever dealt with before now was calling Dick Cheney evil. If you remember back that far to the Bush era, and you know, to me that had been, in my opinion, the worst administration ever. And the universe.
Right.
Remember
when we all got upset because Dan Quayle couldn't spell potato properly?
I do remember that quite well, because I'm older, but yeah, I mean, I remember all kinds of guffaws. I remember Gerald Ford being clumsy. I mean, I remember stuff before that, but I wasn't prepared for pandemic, and I wasn't prepared for insanity from the White House, because we had a certain number of standards that we had gotten used to over decades, and that got blown up. I didn't see that.
Yeah,
coming.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that this pandemic has taught us, if nothing else, is that it's forced a lot of people to do a lot of introspection and self-evaluation about who they are and what they stand for, and how can they try to maintain some sense of normalcy. You know, we have all these large companies that all of a sudden they're like, hey, you know what, we can keep our staff healthy, we can keep our employees alive if we allow them to remote work, which we've never done before. You know, things like that. So I think we're seeing a lot of the good in people. We're seeing people who are coming together and helping their neighbors and trying to make the best of what is really a horrific situation. While I think this year has definitely shown us the worst in many people, I think it's also shown us some of the good as well. And I think that's something to be valued.
Oh, I agree. I mean, when this thing first hit, you know, and people were fighting hand over fist for toilet paper, you know, we saw instances and funny as it sounds, it's true. You know, people were freaking out because the toilet paper was disappearing because we were all going to have apparently diarrhea. I haven't heard that being one of the symptoms, but okay.
No.
And, you know, at one point we were in the grocery store and you know, this one guy was upset. He was at the back of the line for toilet paper. It was about to all be gone, and we had an extra because he had picked up, Mark had picked up one, I had picked up one, and it was like, oh, well, we have extra. Here you go. Have some toilet paper. And the woman saw him give this guy his toilet paper, and I had gone off to another aisle, and he went looking for a leave for me, and he couldn't uh-huh. find it. And the woman who had witnessed him giving up his toilet paper decided that was her opportunity to help him out and find my leave. So, I mean, it was part of the chain reaction. When people do nice things for each other, it makes other people want to do more nice things for each other, which is really cool.
Right.
So we actually got to see firsthand some of the really nice things that people are willing to stop and do to help each other out. Unfortunately, it seems, though, like we've gotten away from that because leadership has been so lacking. And, I mean, I kind of don't recognize shit anymore like I used to.
Yeah.
Things are way
different.
Yeah.
Well,
and
not only that, we're all going stir crazy. I mean, I haven't been in a bar in 6 months, you know, not to say I wasn't doing my share of drinking the first 2 months. I mean, by the end of May, I was kind of like, God, I've gained 30 pounds and I need a liver transplant at this point. But, you know, I think people are starting to go a little nuts. We're tired of staying home. And so people are like, yeah, I got to go to Cracker Barrel, open it back up or whatever.
Right. Oh, I've needed a whole new wardrobe 3 times. You don't even want to know. But,
right. Oh, my God. Yoga pants for life, sister.
I'm telling you what. If I were allowed to work from home, honey, I would be in night clothes all day, every day. I like comfort. But
yeah, well, you know, you think that.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I've worked from home since 2013, and as somebody who is a veteran work from homer, if you work in your pajamas, you are far less productive. Like, I get up every day and I put on real pants, and I, you know, like, once I put on earrings, as far as I'm concerned, I am ready to take on the world. You know, so my commute is super easy. I just step over the dog on my way to the coffee pot in the morning, but I still have to force myself to, like, you know, make an effort, because otherwise I'm just kind of loafing around in my pajamas.
See, and I, as somebody who had worked for several years remotely, I found
mm-hmm.
that the more comfortable I was, not only was I more productive, but I was willing to work longer hours, which my company loved.
Yeah.
She's up at 6. She's finishing at 6 p.m. Hey,
we're
getting more time out of her. This is amazing.
Right.
You know, it's not
she
like
can
I
wear
have
pajamas.
To go anywhere. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't have a commute, so I don't have
right,
to go anywhere.
Exactly.
I mean, it was very convenient, very convenient. And I think some people hate working from home. As a matter of fact, Mark, who I mentioned earlier, he does not, he's one of these folks that says, oh, hell no. If I can go into the office,
really?
That is life. Oh, yeah, he hates working from home. Because,
oh, my God, I would go nuts if I had to go to an office.
Yeah, but see, his feeling is when he's working from home, his day is extended and he doesn't like that part. Because like me, I work extra hours if I work from home. He doesn't want to do that, and he knows he will.
Right.
So for him,
well,
you have to train yourself.
Yeah, you have to train yourself to walk away from it. Like, I have an office in my house, and once I'm done at the end of the day, I walk away from it. Now, I don't go back in there until the next day.
Ah, okay, I get it. You have a separate office in the home that you can close the door and say, okay, I'm done.
Yep. Exactly.
That's
if
great.
I was sitting on my couch,
that's
I'd
great.
Be working 24/7. But no, I have an actual office space. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. No, I had been complaining on Facebook because my coworkers refuse to wear masks. And I'm the only one in the office who wears a mask. The minute I get up from my desk, I put that thing on, and I don't take it off until I'm back at my desk. And this has been an ongoing argument for months at my place of business, where I'm like, one more goddamn time, you fuckers. You spend another day not wearing masks, and I'm definitely going to have problems. So Monday I am calling for a meeting, and I'm going to say, you have two options. Wear the mask, or I'm working from home. You can decide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's inexcusable to not wear a mask when you're around other people. I do.
Right. Well, and, you know, and the thing is, it's, you know, it's not about you and what you need. It's about protecting the good of the community. People are so individually focused. They're like, me, I don't want to. It's icky. It's dumb. It's a hoax, whatever. At the end of the day, you know, if you want to protect other people from whatever you're carrying around, put on a fucking mask. It's not that hard.
It's really not. I mean, I know people don't like wearing them. So I don't
them. Yeah.
But you do it because that's what we do. As we make a decision as a society that we're going to look after each other. Or at least that's what I thought. This is another thing about, you know, this particular period of time where people are just like giving in to their worst instincts. And it's really kind of unnerving when you actually want to consider other people and you know they're not considering you back. It's kind of, it's aggravating for sure. It's aggravating.
Right. Well, you know, I look at it this way. I don't want to wear pants or shoes, but I put them on when I go to a restaurant. I mean, it's not that hard, you know.
and to me, it's like, well, one day maybe we'll just experiment and not put on pants and shoes. There you go.
Right.
Yeah,
maybe
like
I'm just gonna go to Kroger with no pants on. Stop infringing on my freedom. I don't honor the idea of pants.
Seriously, I'd love to see that. I mean, all kidding aside, though, it's a simple thing to just wear briefly. You know, if you have a quick errand, just put it on, you know?
Yeah.
We're not asking you to wear it continuously for 8 hours at a time unless you're in healthcare. Yeah, unless you're in a job where you are exposed constantly to people, then yeah. But anyway, getting back to the book, because I want to talk about the
book. Yeah, let's talk about the book. let's do that.
I want to talk about the book. So, aside from the fact that I really like the book, there's things that you go into that I really appreciate as far as finding out who your ancestors are. Because sometimes folks don't know. And I love the fact that you actually go into ways to search for your people.
Yeah.
Are these things that you had to do yourself, or did you have to research that for other folks, or did you already have that whole genealogy for your family mapped out?
Right. So I started researching my own family history when I was about 15. One of the stories that I think I told in the book is, you know, we were at a family dinner and my great grandmother, who, by the way, I was terrified of as a child, she blurted out that my great something grandfather had killed himself and then had killed his wife and then killed himself. So, you know, at first our thought was, well, she was just saying that to be spiteful and for shock value, but nope, turned out it was true. I have a copy of the 6-page newspaper report from 1892. But that was kind of what got me started in working together with my mom, on working towards discovering our family tree. And this was back in the mid 80s. So back then, if you wanted to learn about your family, you had to, you know, you had to go to the library or you had to write letters and you had to send self-addressed stamped envelopes. So as time went on, you know, obviously the technology that we've seen in the past 20 and 30 years for doing that kind of research has just completely blown up. So all of the stuff that I include in the book as far as here are what the things you can learn from this kind of record, here's how you can find that kind of record, it's all stuff that I've been there and done that, and I've made enough mistakes that I can share the correct way to do it. You know, I'm screwing up, so you don't have to. I've got 35 years of errors on my side. But it's all stuff that I've done over the years, and I've figured out what, you know, I'm a big fan of working smarter, not harder. And if you can get accurate information and you can take it and use your own critical thinking skills to piece together the stories of these people that you've come from, then that allows you to take that genealogical knowledge and put it into play in a spiritual context. And I never started out to be like, oh, I'm ancestor work is part of my practice. I never intended for that to happen. It just kind of unfolded on its own as sort of a natural consequence of me doing all of this deep dive genealogical research. So the more I learned about my people and who they were, and expanding that into things like what would they have eaten when they lived, what kind of clothing would they have worn, you know, what was the political and social climate of the place that they left before they came to the United States, all this stuff. To me, that's all part of the research. That's all part of what allows you to build the story. So I thought it was really important to share information with people about how do I find my people, because. Mm-hmm. Anytime I do an ancestor workshop, people are always like, but isn't it expensive? Don't I have to pay someone? Well, you know, you can. Sure, you can pay for a subscription to Ancestry. Hell, you can hire a professional genealogist if you want to. But if you use the information that's out there for free, there's a lot of stuff that you can unearth. And if you use your critical thinking skills, you can put it together and figure out what comes after that. So that was, I thought that was a really important part, an important component of working with your ancestors, because you can't work with them if you don't know who they are.
You have, say, like everybody pretty much died before I was born as far as anybody beyond my mother and father. So what I did was I went to my mother's side. And, you know, I had one grandmother still alive, so I got as much detail as I could from her.
Yeah.
And now that she's passed, like, she's my link to everybody before her. So, you know, when, depending on the holiday, you know, I'll put out different types of fruits and nuts. She loved chocolate, too. So chocolate.
My kind of gal.
Yeah, I'm serious. She loved race. She loved ponies. She loved pasta. And she loved dessert. Those were her things.
Nice.
So, you know, but everybody who came before her, I revere through her. So because there's so many people that I could go back through, but I feel like I have my direct link on that side. So I honor her. Now, is it appropriate or is it okay if you like incorporate ancestor veneration in basically your daily rituals? I do daily rituals. I don't know. Some folks do, some folks don't. Is there a special time? You know, we're near Samhain. It's the thinning of the veil. Is there something, you know, in addition to the normal practices that I should be adding at Samhain specifically to revere my ancestors?
Well, I'm always reluctant to use the word should when we're talking about people's spiritual practice, because your spiritual practice is as unique and personalized as you are. So I would never tell anyone, well, you should do this, you should do that, what you need to do is this. But there are definitely, I think this time of year, especially, you know, everybody's always interested in ancestor work when Samhain approaches. So what I typically do is I have an ancestor altar that's in place all year round. It's right there in my living room. I walk past it a dozen times a day. I wouldn't say it's front and center, but it's certainly noticeable. You know, it's one of those things that it's part of my daily routine. And I talk to my people as I walk by, and I make sure that, you know, the offering plate has things on it, and I make sure that the cup of beverage is full. So I interact with my people on a daily basis. Usually I find that certain times of the year, they seem to be chattier. So I think it's really important this time of year to listen a little more deeply. This seems to be when they are super active. So for people who maybe haven't done as much ancestor work in the past, this is a really good time to open up that door and say, hey, I know you guys are out there. I know that you've got messages for me. I'm here and I'm listening. What do you got? Hit me with it. Because they do seem to be more, they seem to be more active. But I think as far as, you know, how often you work with them or the types of rituals you do with them, that's going to depend on your people and what you hope to gain or accomplish or achieve with your interaction with them.
Yeah, like, you know, I keep at all times there's a glass of gin and a glass of whiskey. And
yeah, mine like whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, my gods drink better than most people do.
I'm saying.
You know, I mean, I've got Glenlivet and Bombay Sapphire Gin on tap
all
times. To keep them happy and flowing. It's like, yes, please, here's an offering.
Yes.
And I love that you talk about offerings in the book to your ancestors, too. And, you know, should I have a separate, and I meant to ask you this prior to our conversation today, should I have a separate glass of whiskey for an ancestor who would drink it, or is it okay to have the one glass? Or because I have, instead of having a bunch of different altars in different areas, I have four in different parts of the house, but in my main altar, it is a 5-tier altar. So I have like ancestor veneration on one tier. I have current stuff happening on another tier. God and goddess stuff on the top tier. So I keep a lot of it in one space, as it were, because it's a tier, it's a 5-level altar. So would it be appropriate to put another glass of, because of course my grandmother loved to drink. She especially liked beer, but I'm trying to up the game with some whiskey.
Yeah.
It's like, here, I don't need to buy another type of alcohol for you, do I? Have a nip of this, mommy.
So I guess I probably
should get her own glass, right?
Well, you know, I typically have one or two glasses specifically for my ancestors. And like you, I have multiple altars in my house. I have like my main working altar, which is where I do the bulk of my magical stuff. And my Sabbat rituals and what have you. But then my ancestor altar is a separate space in the same room. So I typically have, in my case, it's usually either a glass of 21-year Glenfiddich or Spanish wine or something like that, depending on which group of ancestors I'm working with. So if you've got it all sort of in the same space, but still like delineated as separate, I mean, you can put it in the same space. Unless your ancestors hint to you that they don't like that. And odds are good if they don't, they'll tell you.
Oh, no doubt. I was actually, before I started putting out whiskey and gin, I had been putting out red wine. And at one point, and I think it was because I had run out of rum at one point. So I was like, oh, well, here's the alcohol I have in the house. Have some red wine. And nothing was moving. And then all of a sudden I woke up one morning and there was a film on top of the glass. And I was that's weird. So I threw out everything in the glass again, refilled it with red wine, put it back on the altar. 2 days later, there's a film on the damn glass. I'm like, you hate this, obviously.
Yeah, here's your sign.
Yeah, I mean, they'll make it damn obvious if they're not approving what you're giving. There's no question about it. But, man, I'll tell you what. Since I moved to Bombay Sapphire and Glenlivet, rather, I haven't had one complaint, so I think I'm all right now.
Yeah. Well, and I think sometimes it depends on, you know, I think sometimes you have to do a little bit of experimentation to figure out what they want. I had, and I've told this story in workshops before, but I had a situation a couple of years ago where, so I'm not a big wine drinker. I just, it's not that I dislike wine. I'm just not, there's other things I'd rather drink, but people always give me wine as gifts. Like all the time. I have like I could, you know, I could hunker down in my house and drink a different bottle of stuff for like every night for a month. But a couple years ago, I went to an event and there was like a wine exchange. Like every person had to bring a wrapped bottle of wine and you just swapped it out like a white elephant kind of thing. And so everybody brought home a different bottle of wine than what they came with, which was cool. I was like, all right, whatever. I can save it for guests. So I brought home this bottle of a Spanish red wine called Hacienda Monasterio. And Hacienda Monasterio is like, I can't buy it around here. Like you have to have it delivered. It's that kind of wine. It's like $40 or $50 a bottle. But it's made, I know. It's made from a grape called the Tempranillo, which only grows in a certain part of Spain. So I had this bottle of Spanish red wine and I'm like, you know, this looks really nice, but I am never going to drink it. What the hell am I supposed to do with it? So I kind of stuck it up on top of my refrigerator with all the other bottles of wine that I had never opened. And then I sort of forgot about it. And, but I felt like I was like, I felt like there was something special about that bottle. Like this isn't just like a $6.99 bottle of Yellowtail that someone got at Aldi. This is like good wine. So I was like, I'm going to hold on to this bottle of wine just in case. So fast forward about a year and a half. And I had a situation that I knew I needed some magical intervention with. Like I had a working that I really needed to do. And I wanted to involve my ancestors, but none of them seemed like a very good fit for it. None of them seemed appropriate for it. So I was like, well, all right, I'll get to it when I get to it. So as I'm digging and as I'm doing my research, I suddenly managed to unlock information about one branch of my family that I'm able to trace back to King Ferdinand of Spain, King Ferdinand of Castile.
Oh, no kidding.
He was like my 34th great grandfather or something like that. And I was looking at Ferdinand and I was reading about him. He was later canonized as a saint, Saint Ferdinand or San Fernando. And I realized that Ferdinand was checked all the boxes. He was like the perfect ancestor to work with for this particular thing that I wanted to do. And I thought to myself, well, I wonder if that Spanish wine might come in handy. So I looked at it and I realized that was when I had like one of those aha light bulb moments. The Tempranillo grape, which is what Hacienda Monasterio is made from, is only grown in one place in the world. And that is Castile, Spain. So I thought to myself, it's a sign. Here I have this ancestor who was the king of the region where this grape grows, and now I'm holding a bottle of wine that could be made from grapes that grew, you know, the same grapes that he drank his wine from. So I cracked the bottle open, and I made him an offering. And I did my working, and 2 weeks later, everything unfolded exactly the way I wanted it to, and then some. So it was just one of those fluke things. It's like, okay, I've got this bottle of wine. I'll just hold on to it. And I made that offering with great joy. So,
wow. That's really cool. So I would take from that, even if you wind up with something that you don't think you'll use in that regard, don't poo-poo it. It is probably coming into your hands for a reason.
Right, because at the end of the day, it's not about me. It's not about what I drink. It's not about what I like. What's an appropriate offering for my ancestors. And that bottle of Spanish wine was 100% appropriate for that particular ancestor. And I'm so happy that I happen to have it. And, you know, I don't know if anything's a coincidence or random or not, but it certainly worked in my favor.
It's weird because sometimes I think of those things sometimes I think of everything as being random and not being at all random at the same time.
Right.
Which
like,
is weird.
It's a coincidence, but I don't actually believe in coincidences.
Right. Exactly. It's like, oh, no, that's got nothing to do with magic. Because I'm always like,
right.
Let's look at the mundane first before we just assign a magical reason. Let's not get all ooh about it. You know,
right.
So, and because normally stuff, there is a logical reason. I'm not poo-pooing magic, obviously.
Oh, no, no.
I don't ascribe everything to being of magical content, because sometimes shit just happens.
Yeah,
but anyway.
I think that's one of the mistakes we often make in the magical community, is we just assume everything has a magical reason for it, and sometimes the answer is, nope, shit just happened. That's just the way it works. Or sometimes stuff happens because sometimes things happen because we make terrible choices. You know, all kinds of reasons.
It's so true. It is so true. Oh my gosh. You know, you mentioned in the book dealing with your ancestors as far as, you know, doing divination with them. And I actually did that with my grandmother,
mm-hmm.
and she comes up a lot for me because she's the only elder in my family that I actually got to spend time with. And, you know, it's interesting because I had wanted something and she was still alive and this thing happened in my life and I had to make a choice, and she fell into a coma because she was having surgery. And the coma, she was having an operation for lung cancer, and they got the cancer, but she went into the coma because of the anesthesia. She was 76 at the time. And while she was, I actually talked to her while she was in her coma. And I definitely feel that she heard me. And when she got on the other side, she actually interceded for me in a couple of things. And I'm still appreciative of that to this day, because the trajectory of where I wanted certain things to go went there. Now, the road mm-hmm. wasn't easy, but she
it never is.
Out, you know? Yeah. But I do believe that, you know, I believe our ancestors can intercede for us and help us out from the other side of the veil. So I'm really, that's part of why I love this book, of course, because the book doesn't make it scary, and it doesn't make it beyond anybody being able to do it. There are some books that are, I think, almost like they want you to be overly cautious, or not that you shouldn't be cautious. I'm just saying that the way you put things and your writing style is such that you empower folks to be able to feel like they can do it too, in a real sense.
Well, I hope
which
so.
I love.
Yeah, and I thank you for that, and I hope so. You know, one of the things I've always said is that my goal in presenting information, I don't want to lecture at people. That's, you know, if I wanted to do that, I'd be in a different line of work. I want to have conversations. And I want people to read this book and any of my other books. And I want them to feel like we're sitting at the kitchen table having a cup of coffee talking about magic and shit. The thing with ancestor work is paganism does not have a monopoly on ancestor work by any stretch of the imagination. You know, ancestor veneration has been around for a really long time, and it's something that people of every culture and religious background can do. You know, ancestor work does not care what your religious beliefs are, or even if you have any. It doesn't care about the color of your skin. It doesn't care about your socioeconomic status. Ancestor work is for everybody, but it is for anybody.
And that's another thing I love about the way you write, because you write for everybody. You don't exclude. Mm-hmm. I don't ever, you know, I am multiple things aside from female and gardenerian and a mother and a wife. There's other things in me, in my spectrum of being, and none of me ever feels rejected by your books, ever.
I hope
so
not.
I'm really grateful.
You know, I
know you work hard.
I'm sorry,
on
go ahead.
And I know that's I know that's important to you, and I know that that's meaningful to you, and it shows, because you don't, felt, like I said, no part of me has ever felt excluded by anything of yours that I have ever read that you've written.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I really wanted to make sure that this was a book that everybody felt inclusive, especially in this day and age where there is so much chaos and there's so much hate and anger. The last thing I want is for somebody to read one of my books and think to themselves, wow, this is for everyone except me. I wouldn't ever want anyone to feel that way. And if they did, I would feel like I'd failed somehow. But, you know, and that's one of the things, too, that I talk about in there is, like, you know, we have ancestors who were, not all of our ancestors were like us, you know.
Right.
They may have been on any range of the sexual identity spectrum. They may have been any color. They have been different religions. But once the veil, all of those things, you know, death is the great equalizer.
Yeah, it does. It's so true. I mean, we're all going somewhere, and we may all wind up together, so we ought to treat each other that way on this side of the veil.
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, but the other things I love about it, because, I mean, this book is not just a couple of things. This book is a lot of things. You put recipes in here that are just amazing. I love the fact that you do that.
So I always tell people.
You give references. You're so good.
Yeah.
I love you.
Oh. Well, I always tell people that food is my love language. I mean, it really is. I'm all about hospitality, and I've always felt that the best way for me to show somebody I love them is to offer them food that I've prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to lean towards cooking and preparing foods from scratch because I have the ability to do so, and I know that not everybody does.
Right.
I think if you want to offer your ancestors a meal, I mean, how powerful and connective would it be to learn how to cook something that they might have eaten in their place and time? And I think breaking bread with someone is a huge bonding experience. And even if that someone has been dead for 100 years, you can still do it. So including the recipe section, that was something that I thought, you know, that'll at least give people a kickstart and give them some ideas for what they can prepare for their own ancestors when they sit down for a meal with them.
And I wanted to ask you, when you're done with that meal, what do you do with it once it is no longer appropriate to keep it on the altar?
Oh, so that's an excellent question. So for organic material, like fruits or vegetables, I typically compost them into my garden. For things like bread, I'll take it outside and I'll leave it on a plate for the birds and the squirrels in my neighborhood. Those are the big things that I typically offer. If you've prepared anything that's not going to decompose on its own or get eaten by the local wildlife, you can always dig a hole and bury it. Or if you have a bonfire, you can put it in the fire.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I live in an urban area.
You don't want to throw it in the trash can with, like, all the rest of your shit. Yeah.
Right. No, I don't ever do that. Like, you know, even if I'm getting, like, if I get a delivery of Misfits, because you and I both get Misfits.
Love my
Misfits. A vegetable. Me too. My box is actually outside right now. Somebody's picking it up. I hear them. You know, whenever we do anything with a fresh box for Misfits, we take something out and make an offering with that. And that's what I do with all of the food stuff offerings that we do anyway. You know, some for the gods and some for us, you know. But that's cool. I was just curious as to what you suggested as far as what to do once the meal is completed, so to speak. But that's a great thing. Now, I did notice the herb butter recipe in the book.
Yes.
And I had to ask because I saw you had made butter today.
I did.
I know.
You have not experienced true taste bud heaven until you have made your own butter from scratch. It is the easiest thing in the world to make. It is so easy. Like, you need heavy cream. That's it.
Uh-huh.
So there are different ways you can make it. That's it. Like, I add a pinch of salt to mine because I like salted butter, but you don't have to. But just to make your basic butter, I mean, you can make it in a stand mixer, but if you do that, trust and believe that shit gets splashy and you're going to want to throw a towel over it or you're going to have butter all over your kitchen. But you can make it in your, if you've got like a food processor or a Cuisinart, you can make it in there. The batch I did today, so this is kind of funny story. So my guy and I were at an antique mall about a month and a half ago, and one of the things I always look for at antique malls is a daisy butter churn, which a daisy butter churn is basically a jar, and on the lid, there's a crank, and there's a little paddle that goes into the jar, and you can sit on your couch and turn the crank and make butter. It takes a while. So I've been looking for one of those, and I've never found one that was within my price range at an antique mall, because some of them, I mean, you'll see them for like $100-$150.
Wow.
So it was one of those things. Yeah, that's for the original antique ones. And I was like, it's one of those things I couldn't quite justify buying for myself new. That's a splurge. I shouldn't do. So I had mentioned this to him. Well, my birthday was last weekend, and he got me a daisy butter churn. I was like, hell yeah, fresh butter. So this afternoon, I sat on my couch and I watched a couple of episodes of Downton Abbey, and I cranked and cranked and cranked and cranked, and it took an hour, but I made butter.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
And the cool thing about making your butter, though, is then you end up with, the byproduct, what's left over, the liquid, you have buttermilk. So tomorrow I'm going to make a loaf of bread, and I'm going to make it with buttermilk, and I'm going to smear my fresh butter all over it. Oh, I'm so excited. I can't stand it.
Oh my gosh, that sounds delicious.
Oh, yeah. So good. Well, if you go to the store and you get a thing, you get a carton of cream and bring it home, and just, you don't have to get a daisy butter churn because that is super time consuming. Throw it in your food processor, make sure the lid is on all the way, and just let that thing run for about 5 minutes, and then eventually the cream will separate, you'll have curds and you'll have whey, and the curds, the clumpy part, that's your butter.
Okay, so I have to ask, is it possible for me to make this in my Ninja instead of a food processor?
Yeah, absolutely. I make mine I've made it in the Ninja a lot. But here's the thing, you have to be patient, because what will happen is when you put the cream into your Ninja and you put the motor on the top and you push the button down, so what's going to happen first is you're going to end up with what kind of looks like Cool Whip. It's going to be basically whipped cream. So that's the first step.
Right.
Then it's gonna take a while, and then you'll notice that it starts to thicken, and it kind of has the consistency of like country crock. Keep going.
Yeah.
Okay. Once you get past that, the third phase, it's gonna separate into like clumpy parts and pure liquid.
Yeah.
That's the clumpy parts is your butter.
Okay.
So it'll go faster if you let the cream get to room temperature before you do it.
Okay, well, that's good to know as well.
So if you need me to, call me when you're doing this, and I will walk you through it. We can FaceTime, and you can show me what it looks like.
no doubt, and that may be a necessity. Just so you know, thank you for the offer.
That's fine.
Patty, help me. But we're down to like 5 minutes. So,
oh my gosh.
In the time, I know. In the time remaining, I'd like to know what you're currently working on, if you have another book in the works, when it's due out, the subject matter, all the good stuff. Tell me, give me the 411, lady.
I'll give you the scoop. Okay, so I've got a couple of projects coming up. One of them, I'm not officially allowed to make the announcement until next week, but I can drop, but I can drop little hints that if somebody was interested in reading a book about radical self-care and using witchcraft for healing and stuff like that, that person might want to keep an eye on my website at pattywiggington.com and look for things in the coming couple of weeks, if something like that were to happen.
Okay.
So there's that. Also mark your calendar for, I think, November 10th, because that's when, if I had a book coming out, that's when it would be.
Interesting.
But I'm not official. Yeah, I know. So, but something else I'm working on that a lot of people, everybody knows I write witchy books. A lot of people don't realize I write fiction as well. Actually have a novel that I'm finishing up, working with a publishing company called Wild Rose Press. And, I'm hoping that sometime after the first of the year, I'll be releasing a novel, and it's a Regency era mystery, and it was a lot of fun. I've been writing it for like 10 years, and I finally decided to try to sell it to a publisher, and they liked it. So hopefully that'll be happening in January or February-ish. We don't have a release date yet, but it's coming.
Wow. Okay, I'm excited. We're going to have to read books for all of this, so I guess I'll be picking you up next week for the next interview on the next book. I'm or something.
I would love that. Or something. Yeah. I would love that.
Or something.
Yeah.
Oh, you are so fantastic. Everybody, seriously.
Thank you.
You know, this is a great book, Badass Ancestors. It's one of many books that Patty Wiggington has done. All of her books are fantastic. I'm actually developing quite the library, and I'm very proud of it. It is, her writings are stuff that I give to younger folks who are first getting in.
Aww.
and want to understand. Yeah, I do. And to my family, no less. I do give her books to people in my family, including my children. I'm very comfortable with Patty's writing style. Not overly complicated, you know, let's do things, let's do them appropriately, but let's not overthink it, which I love, because in time of COVID, or if you're just a busy business person, I already have enough to think about, y'all.
Right.
Sometimes I just need to go to the book and say, okay, this is what I'm doing, and easy peasy, lemon squeezy. She's a fantastic person, a fantastic writer. Check out www.pattywiggington.com for all the scoop of what's going on with Patty. Patty, I adore you. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, talking to me about the book, cooking, whiskey, all of it. I love you and can't wait to talk to you again.
Oh, my gosh. You are so wonderful. You are one of my favorite people on the planet. I'm so glad we got to do this. And I miss your face. I hope we get to do Mystic South together next year.
I do, too, because, I mean, Pat, if you've never met Patty in person, she's like one of the best huggers and makes the best smiles and best faces and is just this warm, loving personality that you hear through your speakers. Is no act. This is who she really is. She is very loving, very giving, and probably one of the finest people I have ever had the pleasure to know. So I adore you. I hope other folks get to see you in person soon. I sure as hell miss you. And I will talk to you very soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much again. I appreciate you so much.
I appreciate you too. All right, guys. We're going to wrap it there. I am on tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. with the amazing Christopher Hughes to talk about his new book, As the Last Leaf Falls. So tune in. I know it's an early show. You can also listen to the show on Amazon Music afterwards. The podcast is now on Amazon. You can have your Alexa machine play it for you, and it's a whole nother world for me to, like, somebody told it to say, start playing the podcast, and I had to listen to myself for like 3 minutes, and I started screaming, and then it stopped, which was great. Anyway, you guys, see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care, y'all. Bye-bye.